This is Everything is a Primary Source, the podcast version of zigzagging your way through a thrift store. Every old VHS or record on the shelf, each t-shirt on the rack, and all the books in the bargain bin are actually valuable documents of the time period they come from and the people who made them. I'm your host, Eric Paul, and you can picture me as the store clerk, or not. We can actually end the allegory now. Anyway, I'm excited about today's episode. We've got Amy and Jay from the Sitcom Study Podcast here to talk about one of their favorites, well, Jay's favorite at least, Charles in Charge. It's been a while since I've covered a sitcom as a primary source, but who better to help me do another one than the experts? But first, here's a segment I've recorded with Andrew Johnson, a young actor who portrayed the main character of Little Shop of Horrors, Seymour, during this summer's run of the musical at Prescott Park in beautiful Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The live show is based on a few versions of the story, including the 1986 Frank Oz movie musical that so many of us are familiar with. So I am here in Prescott Park in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, pre-show before Little Shop of Horrors, and I'm here with Seymour from the show, Andrew, who plays Seymour. And thanks for joining the podcast today.
Yeah, of course.
And it's nice that you're getting to perform, because I feel like all season long I've seen one cancellation after another through the weather.
Yep.
Has it been kind of rough?
Yeah, I was in the show last year. I was in Footloose, and we had one or two cancellations with that, but definitely this year has been a little tricky with the weather. But hopefully we get to kind of wrap it up. And
yeah. How many more weeks are you doing?
We have one show tonight, and then we just have next weekend, so four more shows after tonight.
I imagine that probably makes even bigger crowds then.
Yeah, I've definitely seen a lot of turnout the past week, just because people are trying to kind of get it in before we close. But
would you say that this is a perfect spot? I love the set. I love all the stuff. Everything seems to be. Have you seen Little Shop of Horrors in other presentations?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a movie that I grew up on when I was younger, so I was super familiar with it from then. And then, you know, I've seen plenty of productions, and I did it in high school too during COVID and everything. And so it was virtual, which was tricky. That must have, but
I saw a lot of that happening, and people got really, and I would say what I'm doing here also is a product of COVID, that a lot of people really virtual stuff, like they got creative with it. Like different things that they could come up with.
Yeah, I definitely learned a lot. I wouldn't want to do it again, but I did. It was, I did learn some useful things.
Yeah, there's a few things you can carry on with you if you want. But so you're going to be going on in a little while, so I want to keep you for too long, maybe an hour. No. but the question that I think from my dissection template that I think works well is what ideas and behaviors are conveyed through Little Shop of Horrors? So there's a couple different iterations of the story. The first was a Roger Corman movie from 1960, Jack Nicholson's first movie. I have a tape of that I was going to bring, and I couldn't find it for the life of me. I feel so bad. And on the tape, which I think came out right around the time that the musical movie came out in the 80s, it has Jack Nicholson on the cover of it with Audrey too, and I'm like, I don't think he played a very big character in that movie.
Yeah, he really wasn't. And his character actually isn't even in the musical version.
Yeah.
But
they just, because he had become a star by then, they're like, well, I'll just slap him on there. But the original story and then the musical movie that was directed by Frank Oz, and now it's showed up on Broadway. So it has, what is the message consistent? Are the ideas always the same? Or do you think that changes every time it's produced?
I think for the most part it's pretty much the same. A big conversation that I personally had, and just as a cast we had with our director Tom Alsup, is just about like themes in general and staying true to that whole like B horror movie style. And I think for me, like, the one thing that really sticks out is like the theme of like be careful what you wish for, and just like the human condition and greed, and kind of just like the unconventional hero, I guess, aspect of it. And I feel like it just makes a really compelling story, because it's, you care so much about this character even though they're doing all these terrible things. So I think it's kind of, it's a unique story in that sense, where it's like the hero isn't so perfect. And I think it's a really great message, and I think it's a lot deeper than a lot of people really see on the surface level. But
it's funny because those first couple versions of Little Shop of Horrors, you know, they're separated by over 20 years, but they do still fit into that umbrella of Cold War, you know, post-World War II, people being fascinated by things like, you know, aliens and nuclear atomic stuff. It's an atomic age story. And also, like you said, the unlikely hero, the person that you're rooting for that you wouldn't, you know, kind of reminds me of like stories like Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah.
You know, it has like the you're rooting for the underdog instead of the clear cut alpha male. Why don't you root for somebody who is, you know, a little less likely to be and, you know, somebody who's doing something not necessarily, like you said, conventionally good. A lot of unsung heroes in reality in that time period, too.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of matches up with. Would you say that, you know, going back to you mentioned about the B-movie, you know, the B-horror movie kind of thing, that's never really gone away. I mean, they still make them, you know. Why do you think that horror films and scary stories and unnerving type stuff oftentimes falls to the lower budget picture houses?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something really fascinating about the fact that, like, there's just pure chaos, but it's completely real and authentic to the characters. And for me, I think that's one of my favorite parts about the show is, like, they say all the time, like, playing truthfully in imaginary circumstances, like, you have this crazy situation that makes no sense at all, but the way that the actors kind of convey the situation, like, it's so compelling and interesting, and it makes for really funny moments and really dramatic moments. And it's kind of hard to get that in any other sort of style, I think.
Yeah. It was funny because by the 80s, when the movie was made, there was a B-movie actor in the White House, you know, Ronald Reagan. And I remember reading about him. I don't know if it has stayed true for all that entire history of B-movies, but he had to provide his own wardrobe for the movies he made. You know, they didn't have budget even for that. Does that go on with this, or does somebody provide the wardrobe for you?
No, we have a wardrobe supervisor and costume designers and everything, so it's definitely a bit more glamorous than that. But they definitely took a lot of inspiration from both the musical movie and the original. But yeah, luckily we don't have to do too much for ourselves.
Shop at Goodwill for all your stuff. It's funny you mentioned about the thing about people committing to the role. I was over at Strawberry Bank doing the same thing just a little while ago, about an hour ago, and a gentleman chose Dr. Strangelove as his primary source, and was talking about the actor Slim Pickens, who is the pilot of one of the bombers going over to Russia. And I guess Stanley Kubrick, he was telling me, he's like, Stanley Kubrick he told everybody in the cast and the crew, he's like, don't tell them this is a satire. He's like, he thinks it's a real dramatic role, and he's going to play it that way. So he played it straight, and that's what made it that much more, like, funny. It was watching somebody totally committing to their crazy role, you know, thinking that, not knowing it's a comedy, you know. So I appreciate that, and it's almost like a lot of the actors and things that go through the B-movie, you have that more raw style acting they commit more to it. It's like it's not like, oh, just get me for my trailer when you're ready for my shot. It's like they are rolling up their sleeves and getting to work on making the picture as well. Now, do you have aspirations to go into the movies and stuff? Have you been in movies?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going into my junior year at the Hart School in Connecticut for musical theater. So, you know, I would love to perform in any capacity. I'm mainly focused on musical theater and, like, live performance, but I take acting for the camera classes and stuff like that too. But I mean, I'm really open to anything. I play instruments too, so I'd love to teach and do anything like that. But
I mean, it seems to me that usually when you see some of the most talented actors in Hollywood, really anywhere, they are multifaceted.
Yeah,
it's, you know, I think of, like, Anne Hathaway.
You know, for the longest time, I, you know, it was just Disney, you know, princess, like, was that one that she was in? Princess Diaries or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, cutesy movies and just a couple other things. And I saw her one time singing.
Yeah.
You know, Les Miserables. I'm like, oh, my God. She, you know, she's very talented in that regard, too. And then when you, like, it's almost like when you're watching, like, a college, even, like, a Division III basketball game or something like that. It's like you look at the guys' bios, and you're like, oh, they're like the top players in all of their schools. So like when you were in high school, did I assume you did musical theater? And
Yep. I mean, I did this show in high school, like I said, so that was crazy. But, yeah, I've been doing theater in school since, like, I was, like, in preschool. I did my first little play.
Yeah.
So it's always kind of been a thing for me. And last year working here was, like, my first kind of, like, professional, like, paid gig.
That's
so
cool.
It's kind of awesome to be back here again because it's really special
for me. Throw that on the back of the headshot, and, you know, when you get those casting jobs. But that is, I mean, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah,
this,
of course.
This has been really cool. And I hope that this is, you know, I don't think my podcast is going to be much for your resume, but, you know, it's, I think that you're stepping into, on behalf of all of us who love the stage, the screen, thank you for continuing the tradition on, and in this case, the tradition started in 1960 with Little Shop of Horrors and, you know, Roger Corman's ultimate B-movie, you know, extravaganza, and that celebration of hardworking acting continues. So thanks again for stopping by.
Yeah, thank you.
It didn't occur to me until just now, the coincidence of having a gentleman drop by to talk about Ulysses S. Grant right after I spoke with Andrew Johnson. And later that evening, another cast member from Little Shop of Horrors and I talked about the Civil War. It must have been something in the air. I wanted to publish this conversation about Charles in Charge in September because, along with Back to School, this is traditionally the time of year in which the networks start airing their new season of sitcoms. But Charles in Charge and its story is anything but traditional. From a wide shot perspective, yes, it looks like all the other situation comedies of the era, but when you start looking at it closely, it doesn't take long to realize how different it was from the pack. Most notably, Charles in Charge, especially in its second iteration, yes, there were essentially two different series, didn't come out at the same time of year as the other Laugh Track shows. It aired mid-season at first and then went into first-run syndication. Of course, that's not the only thing that sets Charles in Charge apart. And to learn more, here's my conversation with Amy and Jay.
Podcast. I think it's fantastic.
Thank you.
And that's where we found a lot of common ground is our love for 24 to 26 minute long stories.
Yeah. We early in our relationship, I always say it's the greatest innovation of our relationship is we decided to make our own TGIF. Where instead of like jumping around Netflix like everybody else and having to figure out what to watch each night. Especially before we lived together, and so we were only together a few nights a week, we would set up our series of four shows, just like TGIF, and it's like they were onto something with that block of four TV sitcoms, and it was just the perfect thing to kind of unwind in the evening.
It's absolutely right, and I think that that's just the beauty of that media form of the sitcom is that it's just like they know how to make you feel easy to unwind and relax. You know, my household were very seasonal with our sitcoms. In that, well, of course, most of them have fall type feel to it because that's when most seasons start. So, a good episode or a good season of Home Improvement when it's getting chilly out, you know, or, you know, we do a lot of Friends, of course, in the fall and it seems like a lot of these sitcoms kind of own different holidays, so like Friends and Thanksgiving, you know, Roseanne and Halloween, you know, you got all the different ones you can cycle through. So what made you think of doing this podcast? Was it just that kind of love of sitcoms?
Yeah, I think you know, we had like we said, we both really love, I mean, we love a lot of things, but it's like I'm into movies, horror movies and stuff. Amy is into theater, musical theater, and I feel like sitcoms were the thing where it's like we both really like them. Neither of us are like experts any more than the other. It's just kind of like something that, like you said, we kind of bonded over. And there's so many, you know. And so Amy had the idea, like, what if we do a podcast where we talk about all the times that there's a musical episode of a sitcom, you know? And I was like, that's great. But even though there are a lot of those, like, that seems like a finite concept. But my sort of solution was, well, the idea of following a trope, you know, and going, well, all right, what if every podcast we watch a handful of sitcom episodes that all have the same trope, like musical episodes, but, you know, it could be other things. And that's sort of how we came up with the sitcom study.
I love it. Yeah. I was hooked when I saw it on Instagram. It came up, you know, recommended for me. And I love the TV Guide, you know, promos. I'm like, this is exactly, but I guess sitcoms, I mean, a lot of the actors that are in sitcoms do other things. So it's like they're bringing their talents in musical theater or movies or, you know, a lot of different places to this one, you know, central, especially I'll ask you this, and maybe you can tell me if you think that does a sitcom require a live studio audience or at least a laugh track?
Because I know, like, on scary waters there. Look out!
A lot of the animated ones I realize do count as sitcoms, but like the more modern, like Steadicam, you know, immersive type things, would you put that in the same category?
So we talk about that a lot on the podcast, just the differences and the way it feels. One of the things that I think we kind of have come to an agreement on is that when you're in the living room and it's this like multicam setting, there should be a live studio audience. It gives it the right feel. The actors are then required to perform for the people that are there. And when it's added in later or when it happens after, it doesn't have the same rhythm.
Yeah.
Now, that's true for those multicam ones, but we're both a sucker for the single cam ones as well because of the way they're able to tell stories in such different ways. Some of the ones that, well, one we haven't even gone back to yet, which is Malcolm in the Middle, but some of the early ones who were doing that, like we watched a Parker Lewis Can't Lose for a few episodes ago, and I was like shocked. It was so ahead of its time. Yeah. I remember not liking that show when I was young, just thinking it was like a Ferris Bueller ripoff and not being interested.
Which it was, yeah.
Right. But looking back at it now, after watching 30 Rock and after watching Scrubs, you're like, whoa, this is Inception. Yeah. You know, like this is where that came from.
I've discovered more than a few sitcoms in syndication, like Parker Lewis Can't Lose. That was one of those ones that I remember kind of hearing about it, but I think I was a little bit too young. I was, you know, born in 81, so the target audience for that was like teenagers, a little bit older. So I was like 9 when that show came out. So I wasn't exactly who they were looking for. But I remember watching it later on in syndication. I'm like, this is a pretty brilliant show. I liked, you know, talking to the, you know, breaking the fourth wall and, you know, talking to the audience. And
yeah, they're really able to do things with that single camera mode that they can't, you know, with the studio audience. It really is a push and pull, you know, like you asked what makes it a sitcom, and the single camera ones, they're still sitcoms. But what we've discovered doing the podcast more and more is that the way that the ones in front of the studio audiences have like one foot in the world of theater and vaudeville, and like when Richie Cunningham is trying to, you know, climb through a window and he kind of stumbles onto the floor, like you hear the individual people in the audience reacting, you know? So it's like, it doesn't have to be that to be a sitcom, but I think we're discovering we kind of prefer that.
And how it makes it feel like you're a part of it too, just like you do when you're in an audience in a theater, watching something live. There's something to that. And the few times, like there was an Addams Family episode or was it Munsters or something, that they added the laugh track back in. Same with Leave It to Beaver. They had gone out onto the studio lot. They'd shot a bunch of outdoor stuff. And the pacing of the actor's dialogue, they were still waiting for that studio audience to laugh. And then they added it back in, and it just didn't feel right.
Yeah. It's like very canned and just kind of hollow. Today's topic, I asked you to choose one of your favorite sitcoms, and we are approaching the beginning of, you know, well, here in 2023, there's no such thing as really a TV season anymore. Right. You know, shows can start on, you know, any, you know, February 3rd, and, the, you know, it's
and
a
this
new
is
season.
The season to watch old shows, because nothing right. new is coming out.
Because you're not going to worry about missing anything. You're right. But even the show that we're going to talk about today doesn't even follow that rule. So we're going to be talking about Charles in Charge. And no. before we jump right in, could you just give me a little bit of why Charles in Charge? Why did you want to talk about this show?
You just asked a mouthful, Aaron.
Okay.
So we mentioned how we had our personal little TGIF lineup. Mm-hmm. And the first iteration of that, Charles in Charge was our first show, right? We each got to pick two. I picked Charles in Charge. For me, like, the nostalgia is too weak a word to describe my relationship with Charles in Charge. I just, this thing was on in syndication when I was a kid, and we can get into how it went from network to first run syndication, but it was on in the afternoons when I was in middle school, probably maybe first year of high school, and just the between the girls, between, you know, the two teenage girls, Nicole Eggert and Josie Davis, but if we're being honest, mostly Nicole Eggert, just between having a huge crush on her, between the sort of ribald antics of Charles and Buddy, like yeah. everything about this show was just so perfectly custom made for me. That I got so into it in a way that it just, like, now as an adult, when I would get the image in my mind that we're going to watch Charles in Charge later, and I would just kind of picture that set and, like, picture Charles and Buddy talking, it would put me in a good mood.
Yeah.
So, you know, the format for our sitcom, we choose four episodes every
podcast.
Week. The format for our podcast, we choose all these different sitcoms. We've gotten to talk about Charles once over like 25 episodes.
So you've been wanting
so
to talk.
So if you ask us to focus on one thing, like if I have anything to say about it, it's got to be Charles.
Got it. Amy, have you fallen in love with Charles in Charge the same way, or is it kind of like...
So, you know, I have an interesting relationship with Charles in Charge. I'm much more of one of these fans that's like wanting to kind of find out more about the people in real life. Mm-hmm. And so Scott Baio has gone down a road that I am not a fan of.
I in researching for today, I was like, oh, he's one of those guys. Like,
he's yeah. one of those guys. And then you got Willie Ames. He has kind of gone like a Kirk Cameron route. And he does a lot of like religious movies and trying to like, bring people to Christianity. And so they both, I think the question for me is, okay, so how much of that was like burgeoning in the early right. days when they were on, when, yeah. you know, when they were these sitcom stars, because they both had big shows in the 70s as well, and then got teamed up for a movie, right?
They were in the movie Zapped, which to say, like, you could claim to have been sexually assaulted by just looking at the posters of this movie. Just look it up if you don't know what it is. Willie Ames and Scott Baio Zapped. It's rough.
It's so bad. They literally, like, they zap women's clothes off. Oh, like, that's man. What the whole thing is. That's the movie.
I would say that's probably before Willie Ames's conversion. You know,
yeah.
I would
yeah.
hope. Maybe that's you what know, caused it. You
or
know, maybe.
Just in the, you know, in the days of, like, hey, it's no big deal. Like, you know, God wants me to yeah. find a woman. I don't know. But so I sort of begrudgingly came to Charles in Charge. And then it's like, you can't not fall in love with the show Charles in Charge when you watch it with Jay, because he is like, he's so giddy when he says that he gets excited thinking about like it's going to be on later on today. He is like, while watching it, yeah. is like,
so it just like it strikes
so
you
excited.
Just in the right way is what you're saying. It just like hits the right nerve at the right spot.
Totally.
And it's
yeah.
So the way that it works for my podcast is we treat things like TV shows, in this case, a sitcom, like a document of its time, of history. The trouble with a sitcom, though, is that they make lots of them. So I did in my first season, a friend of mine and I covered Seinfeld, and we had to make a disclaimer. It said, okay, so season one of Seinfeld is a product of the 80s.
Sure.
But as time went on, it contributed to the culture of the 90s. Mm-hmm. You know, people were saying the catchphrases from Seinfeld in regular dialogue. There was, you know, in each episode, each season was reflecting the culture around it. So it became like a cycle kind of thing. And that's what sitcoms tend to do.
Yep.
So we have to make that same disclaimer that, yes, the original Charles in Charge is a product of the early 80s. But as time went on, you know, the mirrors went up against, you know, between the show and society. And, you know, I'm pretty sure Ronald Reagan had like a poster of Charles in Charge or like a TV on, like, you know, well, time to turn on, you know.
Sure. And we have one right here. So maybe he had the same one.
He's like, you know, let's get some guidance. So let's look at this as the material. That's the first question that I work with this. And, you know, if you're looking at it, something in a museum that's made out of porcelain, then that's easy. The material is porcelain and paint or something like that. But when it comes to something like a TV show, it's a little less tangible. So what's the general premise for those maybe listening right now that aren't super familiar with Charles in Charge? It has kind of a unique premise to it, doesn't it?
Well, part of it is unique, but part of it is also exactly the same as other shows.
Well, a lot of them came later, though.
That's true.
Right?
Look.
So Charles is in charge of our days and our nights, and he lives downstairs, and it's understood that he's there to take good care.
Yeah. You're getting it all wrong. He's a new boy in the neighborhood.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
He lives downstairs, and it's understood. We talk all the time about how a lot of sitcoms, you know, even going back to the 60s, it's like, here's your normal family plus blank.
Right.
Right. And sometimes it's something outlandish like an alien. And sometimes it's something relatively simple like a live-in servant who's a college student or whatever. And that's what this is. It's a group. It's a family. And Charles is their, you know, essentially their live-in babysitter / housekeeper / mentor. And he's a college kid that lives with them, and he has his friend Buddy. But what I've come to discover as an adult, why this was so appealing, is because it's a family show that has managed to completely excise any aspects of adult life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have a dad who's in the military, so he's never there. He's completely off screen, stationed God knows where. You have a mom who should be part of the show. She's part of the opening credits or whatever, but for one reason or another, she's never in it. The actress playing the mom is just like nowhere to be seen. You have the grandpa, and he comes on once in a while and says a few jokes, but really it's these two young men, Charles and Buddy, these two teenage girls and a little kid. So it's like ice cream for breakfast. You know, it's like all of the stories are about either young adults or teenagers, and you never have to sit through an episode about the mom going back to work or something like that. You know, it's all the stuff you want to see as a 14-year-old boy.
And the first season, there was a little bit more focus on the family. So the first season was one of these like law. I mean, it's none of the people that you recognize except for Charles and Buddy. Mm-hmm. So the first season, Charles and Buddy, and Charles works with a completely different family. What are they called?
They're the Pembrokes.
Pembrokes. Mm-hmm. And then they're replaced at the end of season one. They fired everybody except for Charles and Buddy. And season two, the very first episode of season two, you have the mom and the youngest child from that very first family doing a handoff to the Powells, where we get to meet Jamie and Sarah and the little brother,
Adam,
and the new family. And so, but in season one, you definitely get a few more of those episodes that are more family focused. There's a dad that's present. There's, you know, all sorts of things that go on that are very normal sitcom-y, family sitcom. And then at the end of that season, that was the end of it.
Retooling to make it much more youth-centric was a response to the fact that we have dozens of these shows already of family dynamics. Like, let's get something different.
Yeah, it seemed to be, for one thing, there seemed to be a trend at that time, and again, I'm not an expert on this, but this move of having a network show get canceled and then brought back in syndication, that seemed to be like sort of a thing that was happening. And I get the impression that Bayo himself, right, because Scott Vincent Bayo, we should add, gets director credits on a lot of the episodes as the series goes on.
Well, he is in charge. So,
yeah, right, exactly. Behind and in front of the camera. I get the impression that he had something to do with, like, all right, we're bringing this thing back for season two on syndication. I don't want to dress all weird and nerdy. I want to have my T-shirts be opened and stuff. And yeah, I think if you look, like, you know, sort of one-to-one comparison at Lila from season one versus Jamie from the rest of the show and so on, yeah, it does seem like Take Two is just a little more sort of like ready for Teen Beat magazine.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Well, everybody was brunette and then everybody was blonde. Yeah. So that was a big change.
But I also just wanted to throw in one other thing on this idea of what was it made of, because Charles in Charge was shot on video, you know, and so if we're talking about the sort of physical medium, I think in the 80s, this was kind of a big deal that we don't have to deal with anymore. Now, everything is shot on really nice HD video, right? And it looks great. But in the 80s, you had certain TV shows like Cheers and Designing Women were shot on film, and they look really nice. And then the rest of them were shot on video, like Charles in Charge. And so for me, that's part of the nostalgia, even though it's kind of hard to look at, is that harsh lighting, those beige living rooms, and that cheap magnetic video footage is all part of the rest of it.
It almost looks like home video in a way, by comparison anyway.
And especially if you have the motion smoothing on your television, it looks exactly like you're watching home video.
Yeah. So I guess all that stuff together really does speak volumes about the mid, you know, early to mid 1980s about, you know, because it was not the only show on TV that had a different kind of family. They were redefining what family meant in the 80s. And so this is just another example, along with Golden Girls, even Cheers. I think you could probably, you just brought that up, so it's fresh in my mind, but you could aim that as being like, well, your second family at the bar is kind of filling the void of, you know, meeting the needs, I should say, more of your family.
Serving as an escape.
in a lot of ways. And, you know, so it's like, and, but I love that you pointed out also about, you know, kind of getting rid of the parents. Like, that's a, that's an old, you know, like Disney's been doing that forever, you know, you know, young adult books and stuff to do. It's like, first rule, get rid of the parents, and then you, you know, have your adventure, because otherwise it's going to suck when, you know, mom calls you in, you know, from for dinner. You're like, well, that's the end of that. You know, it kind of reminds me in some ways. I know it was a movie from a couple years later, but Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead, you know, of like the teenager, early young adult, like having to negotiate everything, you know, after the parental guidance is gone, and actually not doing half bad job at it, you know, and like learning that they could handle themselves if need be. I think it's so reflective of the time period because there were people like that. There were people in the similar kind of situations. You know, my two dads is another one, you know, where, you know, you have different definitions of family, but they all kind of, you know, maybe kind of giving agency to people watching that, you know, considering how many people had TVs by the 80s, everyone had a TV.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and we noted how later on the show iCarly, you know, that's much later, but they really make a point in that show to be like, all of these different families are non-conventional in some way. There are no, like, you know, quote unquote, normal two-parent households in that show. Everything is a single mom or a brother raising the sister or something to really, have that sense of inclusivity or that sense of every day is an adventure or whatever it is.
Well, Punky, and there's so many more stories, right? Like if you're thinking about, especially in the 80s, as this is sort of like coming out and like My Two Dads in particular, but there's, these are all stories that haven't been told, right? So because we've had Ozzie and Harriet, we've had Leave It to Beaver, we've had, you know, the Andy Griffith Show, we've had all of these different ways that, you know, we've had a, you know, a widowed father or a widowed mother because we're not allowed to have, you know, true single parents or divorced, you know, divorces on television. And this, we, this family, they're not having the, there's no divorce. They just are, they're living their lives in a different way due to work, right? So they don't have to talk about the emotional strife that would come with that of a broken family or whatever. But yet they still have all of these stories that they can tell. And then even more when you think, like you mentioned, My Two Dads, like the whole first season of My Two Dads is all about them navigating that new family dynamic.
And it's all so very 80s. Charles and Charles, I was thinking about it in the last week or so leading up to this. I'm like, yeah, that's about as complete of an 80s, you know, storyline as you can get, you know, because it just, cool college guy, and you know he's kind of teaching. Not he doesn't know all the ropes because he's only, you know, a few years older than the kids, but enough of that gap in between of like kind of showing
that's
them.
How I think that's how you get all of these conflicts without having to have adults involved. You know, like I watched an episode a few days ago where it's like Charles gets a credit card. And he wants to use it to impress this girl he likes, but then he lends it to the kids and they run up these charges and stuff. And so you have all these different sort of cascading layers of authority. So, you know, everybody doesn't want to get in trouble with somebody else, but it's all functioning without having to have any parents, you know? And it's like you said, it's because of those age differences that they can figure out those stories.
Now, when it comes to the, I think we could probably combine about three questions into one here. And one is, who made it? Why did they make it? And what was their status in society? And I know, like, you could go from all the way to the top brass on this. But, you know, if we kind of, if we add Scott Baio in there as part of the who made it, because
Scott Vincent Baio, okay,
he was the reason they kind of wrote the show around him, right? It wasn't like, we need somebody to play this Charles guy. It was, he was going to be it.
Scott Baio was a legit heartthrob from Happy Days, Joanie Loves Chachi.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about how if you ignore the fact that Happy Days takes place in the 50s, Charles in Charge can be a sort of unofficial sequel to Happy Days and Joanie Loves Chachi. Because Charles, he doesn't have a last name. We don't really know who he is. He could be Chachi.
And Ellen Travolta is his mom in both of them.
Yeah. That's also true. Ellen Travolta... Yeah. John Travolta's older sister plays his mom. And they sort of brought her in when the mom of the actual family wasn't hanging out much anymore. And she's the hammiest one of anybody. Like, her whole function in the show is to get dressed up in weird outfits and wigs and do dances and stuff. But anyway,
have a moment of like of very like melodramatic over the top. Like we watched an episode today where Charles is proposing to a, you know, an ex-girlfriend who's come back into town, and then they get a shot of the family sitting at the table, and Ellen Travolta's just like catatonic. She's like,
yeah,
freaking out.
Yeah,
but yeah, you're exactly right. It's built around Scott Baio and his and Willie Ames too. You know, like we said, the two of them were in Zapped together, and it's like, what if you had a bosom buddies type thing, two wacky guys, but also a family?
Yeah,
they have to take care of a family too at the same time. It seems like it like perfectly straddles over from obviously Happy Days, you know, to the next decade where, you know, Happy Days is one of the best examples of like nostalgia humor. Like everything is just about, I mean, the title of the show is called Happy Days. So you can't get any more straightforward than this is what the show is about. And, you know, a feel good show for the 70s for people in that era, looking back, you know, approximately 20 years. And so you have this character, and, you know, it's because Ellen Travolta is also in Greece. There's a bit part working at the diner, right? So it's like, you know, that's another 70s nostalgia, you know, thing going on, same thing. And it's like they're almost, you know, passing on this torch into the 80s of the same kind of dynamic. It's like we're going to be nostalgia through Scott Baio of the nostalgia show for an era that we're nostalgic of. And there's no shortage of 50s nostalgia, even in the 80s.
The Yesterday Cafe. And within the show, his mom is the proprietor of a diner that's like a 50s throwback diner.
You know, I think the best example of that would be like the Stray Cats. You know, I'm like, what, you know, it's like if you listened to the Stray Cats, maybe not looked at them because they're kind of cartoonish in their 50s look, but just listening to them, you're like, this is rockabilly from like the 50s,
and even
right?
Like on Saved by the Bell and like, those shows, they're always going like, oh, hell, are you guys going to the sock hop this weekend? You know, oh, let's get out our 50s garb again. It's another sock hop weekend.
And even when they're not dressed up, like they're tapered like jeans and, you know, they're even their kind of quasi pompadour, you know, the Zach Morris hair kind of has that, you know, 50s look to it. So it's like, you know, there's this romantic view of the 50s anyway, that's used a lot through it, and it sounds like Charles in Charge really just
it also
is another example.
I was thinking
that,
you know, as much as I love it, it's so ridiculous, obviously, and I think part of the reason for that part, you know, we talk about how in the 80s it's kind of like how sitcoms in general sort of jump the shark, like we get some of the most ridiculous stuff, whether it's ALF or just, you know, just
Small Wonder.
Yeah. Just, you know, all the stuff that we all love to dunk on.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And I feel
the
like
show freaked me out. Yeah.
It's because we haven't, you know, we've passed that golden age, you know, 50s, 60s, whatever. But we haven't started to get like the new voices, you know, that we would get in the 90s and then really get in this century. You know, when you think of those 90s sitcoms, like, you know, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld, like they're still white guys, you know, but at least they had a little bit of like a underdog and a different perspective. And then Ricky Gervais. And then you get into the new century, Tina Fey. And, you know, we're watching Atlanta now with Donald Glover. You get all these new perspectives, new senses of humor. I think in the 80s, it's like, let's go one more round on the merry-go-round with a white family and a babysitter. And, you know, it's like, it's almost like this incestuous thing. We've been doing the same ideas from the same basic people over and over again. And that's how you get these sort of jump the shark lameness.
And they're just kind of like pulling what they liked from the previous decades. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, so Alien, my favorite Martian, we'll take Alien.
And the same stories, right? Robot that's Girl. why we're able to do our podcast because you can think of anything that might happen in the lifetime of a family, and you can find at least 14 sitcoms throughout the ages that have had episodes on that. And a lot of sitcoms will have multiple episodes on it. You know,
right.
We said, oh, let's do Back to School 45 different episodes we could find. Oh, bumped on the right. head. Oh, bumped on the head subcategory, bumped on the head amnesia, bumped on the head, you know, personality change, bumped on the head this. Like, there's so many, and they just do the same thing over and over and over again.
In a way, that's kind of what I like about sitcoms, but in our bingy TV viewing lifetimes that we have now, it gets redundant fast.
You can't binge these old shows. The old ones.
Right, because they're just like, I can't even. We've been binging the show Outlander recently, and I'm like, man, they keep recycling the same storyline like every other episode. Somebody's being kidnapped or, you know, put into a jail or something. And it's like, and that too. You know, it's like Game of Thrones light, you know. But it's like, if I stretched it out and watched one a week, it probably wouldn't have shown up to me that way. But because I'm watching them back to back to back, it shows up for sure. Before, and I like this question a lot, the intended audience. You mentioned before how when you were watching the show in the 80s, it seemed like it was made just for you. And, you know, simultaneously, there was a TV network, Nickelodeon, that was made just for kids. And they tried really, really hard to make sure that it was not stupid and like kids would actually not feel like they're being talked down to. And Charles in Charge has that in common. And I just, you know, before we dive into that just a little bit, I remember a lot of what I learned about Nickelodeon came from a great documentary called The Orange Years, that's on Hulu. And it's all about the, you know, beginnings of Nickelodeon to right about the turn of the century. And, they point out that when they started making their own programs like Hey Dude and Salute Your Shorts, they went right back to they're like, well, we have a fresh new audience. They, you know, kids from the ages of, you know, 9 to, you know, basically tweens have never had a show made for them. So we have total license to go and recycle all those old tropes.
Yep.
You know, somebody gets a bucket on their foot, or the, you know, the two people have a crush on each other, but they, right, exactly. Let's do that again. And I guess Full House kind of fits into that too, but it seemed like Nickelodeon and a handful of network shows had that. Would you say Charles in Charge could easily be that, since intended audience?
Yeah, but I think what Charles in Charge has that some of those don't is that when you're that age, when you're like 12 or higher, or really maybe any age when you're a kid, you don't want to feel like you're watching stuff for kids. You want to feel like you're watching stuff made for something, for somebody a little bit older than you. And so, like, don't get me wrong. You say, Hey Dude, Salute Your Shorts. Like, I know every episode. I was totally into those. But I think Charles in Charge hold this trick on us, or me anyway, where watching that after school in seventh grade, eighth grade, I felt like I was watching a legitimate sitcom.
The big kids show.
Yeah, like something that was a legit show, that was a real thing. And the fact that it was funny and silly was hilarious to me. And I don't know that I necessarily clocked the difference of like, oh, the people who are watching, I don't know, All in the Family, maybe a more sincere, you know, proper show, are not watching Charles in Charge, you know? And so to me, it was just, it had like one level up on perceived maturity, even if it wasn't real maturity, that made me go for it after I had maybe put aside Hey Dude and those shows.
Well, and you've got Charles and Buddy, who are college kids, played by kids that are, you know, played by 20-year-olds, almost 30-year-olds that are, you know, well out of college and or never went. But, you know, and I think that just like that, like their maturity being these sort of like men about town, wanting to try to sort of quiet that down a little bit because they're playing the role models in certain ways. Buddy got to play it up and be, you know, the dumb one and in different, you know, and always chasing after women. Whereas Charles was always trying to thread this needle of, you know, not being too promiscuous so that he was a bad role model for the kids, but then also not being such like a nerd, like so prude and like staying away from the ladies and just being about school, that he wasn't appealing to people who were like, oh, I want to get out and party too.
Yeah.
Right. Because you want, I mean, every show, of course, wants as many viewers as possible. They're not going to be like, no, don't watch this show. And so it's like, I like that idea of it masking itself perfectly, that a younger audience is like, I'm cool because I watch it. And I think I do remember kids when I was like in junior high, you know, late elementary school, kind of, you know, like, yeah, I watched
it. It was on.
Like that, you know, it was like, yeah, their way of saying that they're
more
mature.
It was in syndication. It was on reruns for so long that you had Nicole Eggert already grown up in Baywatch, like full on sex symbol, graduated from her Teen Beat era, Tiger Beat era. And so like, I remember kids watching both being like, oh yeah, Nicole Eggert, like I'm going to go watch her when she's my age. Now I'm gonna watch her grown up.
Yeah. That's such a crazy, like,
yeah, for some reason I couldn't handle it. It was like, I never, that was too, like, grown up for me.
I've never watched a single episode. I never, and I know it sounds probably, you know, silly. I think the most I ever watched Baywatch.
Maybe it's because I don't like
Chandler and Joey on Friends. You know, just like, yeah.
Sure.
Like, I know the premise of the show and I know all the major characters. I watched Knight Rider, so I know David Hasselhoff, you know, from that, but I just, yeah, to me, I just felt too mature for it.
Yeah.
When it came out, I was like, I don't know, like, this is kind of stupid. So if I want to, you know, see the images, I'll just, you know, get a Sports Illustrated, you know, swimsuit edition. I don't need to, you know. Anyway, so Scott Baio might agree with us. I don't know. Yeah, he's like, yes. So the way that my dissection tends to go, you know, it does have an order to it, but as the conversations go, we tend to cover things as we do it. But, you know, one of the questions that comes up is what behavior or ideas are conveyed through it? And you already touched on that quite a bit with episodes, and particularly with Charles trying to balance out who he is. Now, another way that this is an indicator of the time period is that I don't think this kind of show would have been thought of in previous eras, because College Guy wasn't really as much of a, like, could you picture a 1960s family being like, hey, that big man on campus, he can watch our kids, you know, like college, you know, like by the time you get to the 80s, everybody's going to college, and most of the people going to college are like, oh, I need to find a place to live. You know, I'll live in with his family. They have a room to rent and take on these extra toys.
True.
It seems a little
it
bit more plausible,
a
bit more 80s.
Like, sort of inappropriate at any time, I think, which is maybe part of the premise of the show, right? Let's not forget the last line of the theme song is, I want Charles in charge of me, right? It's these women singers, and it gives it this little twist. Like, yeah, Charles is in charge of us, and we like it because he's sexy. And so I think there's this weird tension built into the premise of, like, this is kind of a weird setup, but Charles is a really good guy, so it works.
And because when you watch it, you realize it, like, they are too close in age to be, like, Jamie and Sarah are too close in age to Charles to be able to be, like, being watched by him, right? Like, nobody wants their 15, 16, 17-year-old daughter hanging out with a 20, 21, 22-year-old college guy or his friends. Yeah.
Right. Which, to be fair, they never address that ever.
Except for the times. Yes, they do. Except for the times that Jamie starts dating one of the guys at the college.
Oh,
and that's like this big, oh my gosh, kind of episode, because they're like, this is so weird. And all the times that Charles is dating girls who aren't in high school, but who are played by actresses that are the same age as the actresses. Like, Tiffany Amber Thiessen comes on and is playing Charles's girlfriend when she's 15 years old. Before she's cast in Saved by the Bell, she plays Charles's girlfriend. She's younger than both Nicole Eggert and Josie Bassett, who plays the younger sister.
Josie Davis.
Josie Davis. She's younger than both of them, but she she was playing Charles's girlfriend in the episode, all they had to do was make her boobs come out. Like, she just had sexy, you know, she was wearing sexy clothes and her boobs were out. But like, and that happens over and over and over again. And so when you watch it now and you're looking at them and you're like, that, wait, they're the same. Hold on.
Yeah, Matthew Perry's in there. We just watched one with Jerry O'Connell, Sally Struthers, Natalie from Facts of Life is Buddy's alcoholic cousin at some point. Yeah, everybody's in there.
Was it, that what the credit said? It was Natalie.
No, but she gets a very special episode. Like she
doesn't
it's
have a
all
name,
about just alcoholism and how to like go into get treatment and whatever, how it can ruin your life.
Now, one of the things that I always wondered watching these kinds of shows and like Revenge of the Nerds brings us up to him. Like, didn't they have dorms in college in the '80s? Cause you know, Charles, he's going to, you know, quote unquote Rutgers. Yeah. I mean, it's basically, you know, it's in New Jersey and everything. Like,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure they have dorms for college kids. Like, why is he? And you know, like they have so many other, like, okay. And I guess in Revenge of the Nerds, like the jocks get moved into, you know, cause they're, frat house burns down, so they
there's a
move
couple
into
episodes
the
about
freshman dorms,
about that,
so
right? Because Buddy lives in the dorms for at least one, maybe two seasons. Buddy lives in the dorms, and he's kind of constantly trying to convince Charles to come and like be a normal college kid and hang out with him in the dorms and party and
they
whatever.
Pledge a fraternity in one episode.
Yeah, and I think it just every time that happens, it just works out that it's like, oh, you know, there wasn't enough room, or he got another roommate, or oh, this girl needed space, so we're gonna let her have the room instead, ha ha ha, you know, kind of a thing. And he's just like, that's okay, I'm happy where I am.
Yeah, Charles at the end of the day likes being in charge. Like, he likes his setup and the family likes him. So just like any sitcom, you have the occasional what if our whole setup gets disrupted, and then never mind, back to the status quo.
You know, they never address how much he gets paid either.
Right.
No, I think he gets paid in like room and board, basically.
Early on, there's a lot of episodes about money, right? Where they're like, oh, we got to scrape together $50 so we can go on spring break in Daytona. Yeah.
I think Charles gets a modest stipend. And that's
a modest stipend.
College is such a difficult topic to cover on a TV show. Because college is so, I mean, high school you can get away with because, with the exception of Southern California, pretty much all American high schools are generally the same in appearance. And
they look
and
like
everything.
In Southern California.
College is so hard. Yeah. They're all outdoors. You know, kind of like 90210.
My high school is also outdoors.
You know, go class. Okay. Anywhere there's oranges growing, you have, you know, similar kind of high school experiences. Whereas college, it's each institution is pretty unique.
You can have all these different, like, oh, hey, I just started my new, you know, art history class, or oh, I, you know, like they're always taking different courses, and so it gives them all these stories. And they very rarely go to the college. They do once in a while, but I don't think you ever see a campus. Right. You just see occasionally the inside of a classroom or an office. Ben Stein is in there somewhere as a teacher or an administrator.
It's just, I think it's because that's why we don't see more college based, you know, sitcoms. And it's also with the understanding, I think, that like a lot of college kids, you know, they're not your main audience because they're
Well, most
weekday nights, you know, they're out partying.
You're
supposed
to go to
like
college
studying,
for 4
you know,
years
like,
in know, most was cases. So you've got this very finite thing built into your show that it's going to be, you know, your people are going to age out.
Well, and you do the thing that happens in all the, which is the, you know, you hold the brightest kid in your family back from going to college just so you can get another season out of them. Like, oh, Carlton, you're going to go to Princeton, right? Well, first you're going to go to this little community college where Will can get into, because we need to have you on for another season.
Here.
Well, yeah, if the cliche is you have a show about high school kids and then you contrive a reason that they all go to the same college. So if you have a show about college kids, then you have to contrive a reason why they all like go to work for the same law firm or something at the end of the fourth season.
Right. Beverly Hills 90210 kind of did that. You know, they
Saved by the Bell too.
More or less, all went to the same college, and then got similar jobs.
Yeah,
you
Saved
know,
by the
right
Bell.
Afterwards,
the college
they
years
stayed in
at
touch
first,
with each other, and
they at least had probably because she didn't want to be in it, but they had Tiffany Amber Thiessen refrain from going to the same college.
She
as
was
the
on 90210.
Yeah, and then but then she joined them after the first season.
Yeah,
she was like, "Never mind, I'll go here too."
I miss my friends. They're having adventures without me. I have to go to this random school.
There's one question that I kind of use sometimes. I almost always don't for what we're doing here, because almost all fiction is, you know, it's prescriptive, not descriptive. Like, there's nothing factual. But were there any episodes of Charles in Charge that were reacting to any real life events in the 1980s? Like, for example, I think about the Punky Brewster episode post Challenger, where she talks about Kristen McAuliffe and you know, dealing with it and everything like that. And I think there's a few episodes on TV that dealt with the Challenger. Did Charles in Charge ever tackle? Because it had its heartfelt moments. It had its, you know, lessons to be learned.
It had
and stuff,
lessons
but they didn't,
to be learned. But the ever... thing that jumps out at me so much is that, you know, going back to your point about the kids shows, if you judge a sitcom by the way that they resolve their conflicts, this was very much a kids show. Because on a show like Family Ties, for example, they're going to resolve conflicts through communication, through discovering you have to, you know, listen to and consider other people's perspectives or whatever. In Charles in Charge, they resolve conflicts with disguises, with schemes and capers. Everything is about like silly, outlandish things. So in that sense, you know, the lessons and stuff, like they were not that big on that aspect of it. But in terms of real life things, I can't think of any like actual current event type things.
No. And I wonder if that had something to do with the way that they were in syndication, right? So they oftentimes were aired out of order. Like when you go to try and look up in, you know, like a Wikipedia or IMDb or something, if you try to look up the order of the episodes, it's different. And the air, because they're trying to order them by air date, but they were shot in a different order. So there's all sorts of like huge, weird jumps where like Charles has been dating this girl for 6 weeks. We've never met her before. She's not. And then like two episodes later, it's like, oh, you know, this girl that Charles just started dating and it's the same girl. And you're like, hold on, wait a minute. So things like story pieces like that get all out of order. And, but their favorite thing to do is have the like girl that either Buddy or Charles has been dating show up and talk about it like they've been together for 6 weeks, a month, a year, or whatever, and nobody's ever seen her before.
Yeah, there's no continuity with that kind of stuff. I will say, like, the closest thing they do is like they'll hit on like general cultural trends. Like there's an episode where they go to a Kiss concert and they get dressed up in the Kiss makeup. We just saw one where Charles, he's obsessed with his little digital electronic organizer. Remember how back before phones and all the, you know, before iPhones and everything, we just have these little like Pocket Mate organizer things. Yeah. And so
calculator size
stuff
things.
Like that. That's maybe like a general, like something that was popular over a period of years that they can like remark on.
I guess the biggest like gestation that comes from all this analysis to me right now, and it, I don't know why it's just now hitting me, but it really seems to be of an era of the Latchkey Kid. That, like so many of the other shows, it caters to that age group that's coming home. And even the premise of the show kind of generally, you know, like parents are absent. They're not part of the story at all. And so, you know, having that is, it is a great document of the era of not only the storylines itself and the setting is very much Latchkey-esque, but the fact that it was on syndication in the afternoon when those kids were coming home from school and, you know, didn't have any supervision. They're like, all right, I'll watch this. Yeah. Maybe
it's like the reverse for adults. Like we don't have to worry about keeping the adults interested or keeping this credible because nobody's watching this except 13-year-old kids, you know, at home.
they're not around. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're busy at their office, like, oh, you know, with stacks of paper everywhere. And like, I can't wait to go home and watch, you know,
yeah, I was going to say
80s TV show for me. Yeah. 30 something. Yeah.
Or,
oh, I loved Moonlighting.
I didn't even know until recently what that show was about. Mm-hmm. I remember watching it, but I was like over my head, like as to what they were doing, that they were private eyes. Like, I thought they were just slamming doors on each other all the time.
We have a whole series on our show of Will They, Won't They's. Oh, man. Bruce Willis and, Cybill Shepherd.
Cybill Shepherd, so good.
And
it adds to one of the best parts, but quickly forgotten and misunderstood from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, when April O'Neil and Casey Jones are in an argument, and then they go to their respective rooms and slam the doors behind them, and I think it's Donatello's like, kind of like Moonlighting.
Corey Feldman, right? And it was kind of like Moonlighting.
It's been wonderful talking to you. I feel like we've gone for hours and hours and hours because we have such similarities and interests. And one of my favorite quotes is, media is made to be analyzed. Like, that's why it's made, is for us to talk about it. And I think that whether it be Charles in Charge or absolutely anything else that's ever been created and put out there for us to take in, we're not doing our job if we don't think about it and, you know, use it in some way. So I appreciate you taking the time to do this with me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
I would like to thank you all for listening to the EPS podcast, where everything, including Charles in Charge, is a primary source. We'll talk to you next time. Like I mentioned in the interview, I recall Charles in Charge as being the show that the older kids watched, and that's what made it cool. Turns out that was by design. The program had a very narrow target audience, young teenagers, but it was one that carried a fair share of clout in the mid to late 1980s. These latchkey kid mall wanderers had a presence in society and therefore a place in pop culture to call their own. Nickelodeon plugged into this group the year after Charles in Charge went off the air with their show 15, which came out in 1991, and I remember feeling the same way towards that show on Nickelodeon as I did in Charles in Charge. I was a little too young to really have it speak to me, but the age group, early teens, needs agency just as much as anyone else. The 80s and early 90s is really when they were in charge. I've been listening to Amy and Jay's show, The Sitcom Study, for the last few months, and if you haven't started listening yet, what better time than the present? You can find them wherever you get your podcasts, as well as on Instagram. That's where I came across their program. You can follow this show online, and the best starting place is everythinghistory.com. That's everything-history.com. There you'll find links to all my social media pages, as well as information about other Everything as a Primary Source endeavors. Follow and rate the show wherever you're listening to it now. That way you never miss a new episode. Speaking of which, next week is about surf guitarist Dick Dale, with special guest and Dick Dale's protege, Laramie Dean. Until then, this has been the EPS Podcast, where everything is a primary source.